Speaking of Reliability, a podcast with good friends talking with you about reliability engineering topics.
Welcome to Speaking of Reliability. This is Kirk Gray.
And this is Fred Shankleberg.
Hey, Fred.
Hey, Kirk. Good to hear from
you again.
Hear from you again. Yeah. Hey, you know, it's... You sent me a note the other day that said you got a question from one of our listeners. Somebody actually said, hey, I've been listening to you for a while. That's always good to hear. I like that.
Oh, yeah. I really appreciate, you know, feedback and questions. And in fact, he sent two questions and we'll try and answer both of them as much as we can, as well as we can. And the first one was, I think you may recall it. Is how many samples do you need to perform an ALT? ALT.
ALT. So,
yeah. Right.
The simple answer is as many as you can get.
Yeah. Yeah. As everybody has been in a development program knows, samples are, you know, allocations of non-revenue producing products, you know, where you have to test, is always a struggle on how much the company wants to invest in prototypes or pre-production units, which are, of course, much more expensive than the volume production that you would go into later. And, you know, a lot of times, sometimes they're hand-built or built in a small contract manufacturing facility before you go to a full production facility. But I guess I address those questions. The ALT, how many samples do you need in ALT, is really, I would divide it up between mechanical issues, mechanical wear out issues in mechanics like switches and buttons. And this is where you can come in more of your expertise in statistics and, you know, confidence levels and all the other things you want to statistically derive from your testing. Mm-hmm.
Well, it really depends. The sample size question always depends on, well, first off, what are you trying to learn, right? What are you trying to understand? If you're trying to estimate the time to failure of some particular failure mechanism, well, what do you already know about it? And if you already have a good model and you have a good understanding of it, so let's say you have a physics of failure model, well, you might not need any samples if that model is deemed close enough to what you're actually doing. Just use the model, right? But if you don't know what the variability is, you don't know how it's going to exactly manifest itself with different variations of, you know, one item produced versus the next one, well, then you need enough samples to estimate that variability. And that's a whole different game. And if you don't have any model whatsoever, you just know this is a wearing pattern on this thing and we want to know if it will last long enough, well, and you don't have a way to, you have a way to accelerate it, say add more load or longer duration of friction or whatever, then you'll need multiple stress levels and you need enough samples for each stress level to get a good estimate of how it fails at that stress. And then it's another model then to convert those accelerated times of failure or wear patterns back to use conditions. And so I always say you need more than you have, it's more than you're willing to use, because all the things you just mentioned, but it's a trade-off, right? If you have, you know, only a couple samples and you want to learn about variability, well, you're just not going to get there from here. So,
Well, you may, it is a trade-off, and you may decide, I mean, you may, if you know the mechanism that you're concerned about, say a gear, a switch, you know, I'm talking about mechanics.
Right. Like, let's say it's a dome switch. A dome switch is, and we know that somebody's going to push a button on it and it's a dome switch. Well, how many cycles will that last in our configuration? And that's a good question.
It's a good question. And you do have to run it to an endpoint, to some measurable change in the device. And that can be quite extensive. Yep. Also, you talked about a three-tier stress profile, you know, profile samples, so that you can see how relate the stress to the wear speed and make some estimate. Because again, you're not going to know completely the variation in the end use environment. You may not know the variation in the manufacturing process. So hopefully you have enough samples and you're using the manufacturing process for those samples that it's going to be used or comes from the same supplier, vendor, whatever, because that's going to make a big difference too.
And you see that in test plans a lot as they, you know, and even vendors will say, we took samples from three different lots, for example. So they're not all from one batch from one line. You pick from different lines. And it's, it's, I mean, we're painting a broad brush here, but it, to get the sample size correct is really, what are you trying to determine? And what are the factors that influence that outcome? And so there's a lot of engineering that goes on before you get down to sample size.
Right. And I'm sure management will tell you, can't you, or ask you, can't you get information with less samples?
Oh, sure. Give me 5 years ago and study it. I want to go get a material science degree first, then I'll have it. Yeah, no worries.
But you've got to have something that's reasonably going to reach an endpoint. To do an alt test, you've got to either have some mechanism that's reasonably going to reach an endpoint or going to change at a reasonable time for you to measure that change. Okay. Yeah. So when it comes to solid state electronics with a, with no moving parts on a circuit board,
And it's only going to be a 5 year life on a product. Then I fully agree with you.
Even 10 year
don't even bother with it. Yeah.
Don't bother with it. It doesn't make any difference, but do find a weak link.
Yeah.
Do find the most sensitive component in there that causes you to causes the device either to have the highest variation in its strength, I guess that would be called, you know. And this is by testing to limits, again, going to up to operational limits, up to destruct limits, sometimes destruct. Really, folks, it's really hard to destroy, except for vibration, and even that can take a while on a very small circuit board. But
I heard a good one yesterday. It was these guys were encapsulating their circuit boards. They were potting them, basically, to, you know, keep moisture out and all the other stuff. And
trap and contaminants in.
Oh, no, no. They didn't run the test long enough to find that. They did thermal cycling, rapid thermal cycling, and it ripped components right off the board. The epoxy overmolding, it was so stiff compared to the circuit board that it, and it was a good sized board, I imagine, that just sheared parts right off.
The thermal coefficients expand quite different. And
yeah, you got to pay attention to that stuff. Those coatings, they're not forgiving.
Yeah, you know, and my recommendation would be never, you know, do that, do the halt test, the thermal cycling test on the board before you put the conformal coating on. And it's like potting, you know, I've seen, you know, in little bricks where they pot all the components. You've really got to do the halt, thermal halt, any maybe vibration, but you should do it at least both stages, maybe unpotted, but unconformal.
Well, I agree with, I totally agree with that, because once you pot it, it's really hard to do debugging and sort out what's going on and, you know, heat up one component, you know, do stuff like that to find cold solder joints. It's encapsulated now. It's a pain. You can do it, but it's really much more difficult once it's coated. So get it right first on the board, right? And then coat it or, you know, pot it.
Exactly. First, do all your testing as far as vibration, you know, everything with that. But then the conformal coating does add, as you just illustrated, its own stresses, you know, from thermal, the components themselves heating up. And if it, you know, if you can cause it to crack or rip off by thermal cycling, then there's a risk that even when the components, and depending on the end use environment, suddenly going from a very cold condition and then the individual components heating up, if there's a high wattage component on there, would possibly do the same thing.
Yep.
So that'd be a good test. I mean, it'd be a good thing to observe and or know about if it's that stiff. But in general, I don't think alt is reasonable for and useful for solid state electronics with no moving parts. I mean, there are items, batteries, that you have to worry about sometimes. And it's really been occasional problems with aluminum electrolytic capacitors. Mm-hmm. that do have some kind of, you know, wear out because of the leakage of the electrolyte or the, you know, it's a sealed.
There's also dielectric liquid breakdown of the oxide layers. There's electromigration if you got a real high current application. There's corrosion on the board if you've got contaminants present or the introduction. I mean, I can go into quite a few different places where you want to understand it.
That component is kind of, you know, has been historically one of the weak links in an electronic system, although many times a failed capacitor doesn't cause failure of the system. It's just
it depends on where it is. If it's a decoupling cap, it's no big deal. But if it's in an RC circuit, then and it's modulating signal strength, then it's a big deal.
Right. You know, but if it's just a transient suppression and you don't get a lot of transients, and you know,
you might never notice. Yeah,
you may never notice. So that's. But focus on that one component. If you want to find the life of it, then you know, go with it itself by itself sometimes, and maybe and apply the stresses specifically to that component.
So anyway, I think, I mean, we've answered the question is basically how many samples? It depends. You know, there's a lot of work that goes into designing an accelerated life test that will get you meaningful answers. There's no fixed number.
Ask for more than you need because you're not going to get what you ask for.
Well, there's that too. There's the practical advice of, you know, and the trouble is they know you're going to ask for twice what you want. So you got to, you know, it's a game, but be honest about it. Is what is it you're trying to determine? How well do you need to know it in order to make a decision with the results? And then back into, well, what do you need to do to get that answer? And I've done that. Early in my career, I did tests where we're exploring a brand new novel solder attachment method, and they were going to make 1 million a month of these things. And it was like, if we get it wrong, we're going to have 3 million of them on the shelf before we know it's bad. So we need to know it's going to last. And so we backed up and we did sample. We made test boards instead of using products, because then we could put a lot of these solder attached systems together and thermal cycled them and monitored for failures. And it was crack solder joints we were after. And we ran it till we got enough failures. It took us about 9 months to run the test and at three different stress levels. And we got a really decent model that confirmed some of the theoretical stuff we assumed. And we were able to say, no, this will last well beyond 10 years with a very low probability of failure. And so I remember I was doing the briefing, you know, saying, hey, this looks pretty good. You can ship this, right? And here's my evidence. Here's the data. And one of the operations manager, I'm passing around the test boards that have these components on it. And he's like, well, I can't even see this thing. And he gets his keys out and he starts trying to chip the component off, and he's breaking the edge of the component, not the solder joint at all. So he was kind of distracting the presentation. So I walk over to him and I just twist the board. I just do like an S twist on it.
Yeah.
And the part popped right off into his lap. And he says, now, I know a lot about how these things fail. And the way we use it, if you don't do this, they will last a long time. And he's over there still with his keys trying to chip these things off, and they would not come off. It's like, okay, whatever.
Yeah.
Have a good time.
It's just the manufacturing process and the way electronics are built, they're generally much stronger than they need to be. They have very significant, I mean, a desktop computer that I had worked for Dell for a long time and tried to break a lot of the motherboards, and they're very robust.
Yeah.
And, you know, that may bring us to the
What was the second question? I think you were just leading
into that. The second question is, when do you stop improving a product during a halt evaluation process?
I remember hearing Greg Hobbs's voice on this at a small seminar he did here in the Bay Area. It's like, you don't stop. You keep improving until you run out of time and money. I mean, and he was kind of the opinion that you keep going until you get to the fundamental limits of your technology. And if it's the wrong technology, you change the technology.
You just hit it. The fundamental, it's also a little bit of the application, but the fundamental limit of technology. For instance, you know, it's kind of like when you take a sample and go up, you know, you, first of all, you have to have probably a minimum. We always recommend a minimum of three to five samples for a halt test is a good start. But when you get to a point of, first of all, you know, going to limits and then comparing between those samples, and if you have five, that'd be great. Mm-hmm. And seeing if you have a large variation, first of all, in the operational limit and digital systems,
yeah,
either operation or destruct.
Yeah.
And if you destroy a component during a thermal halt of a digital system, I think you're really got a big red laser arrow pointed at it as far as this is a problem.
Yeah.
Because generally the skewing, thermal skewing of timings in the system disrupt the signal integrity and eventually cause a lockup or a blue screen. Mm-hmm. But rarely have I destroyed things before having a operational failure.
Right.
So in general, I've not gone much further and don't see much point in going much further in a thermal operational limit test beyond its operational, because otherwise you're going up to a point of, you know, past the fundamental limit technologies. For instance, we have done this by in a halt chamber, not directing the airflow right, but melting solder.
Oh, yeah. You can get those chambers pretty darn hot. I've had it where we've melted polymers, we've melted, you know, the coating on the display fell off and shorted, you know, and we just had all kinds of stuff that we go, well, let's take that off and go back at it. I agree with you, Kirk. A well-designed and manufactured product is robust. It will go to the limits of the chamber. I've seen stuff operated at -100C to +200C and just tick along all day long. Had no problem.
Exactly.
Now, I wouldn't want to do that all day long. And the circuit board started to discolor. That was our biggest thing that we saw. And it's like, okay, whatever. But it's robust. But I've also been in the chambers, and you've been there, where I'm at 60C. And I'm getting failures and parts falling off and you know, and just things, just what with, this is not working, you know?
Well, yeah. And this is where, you know, experience with performing halt in previous products, and all circuit boards generally look the same. You pull them out of a pulse oximeter, you pull them out of a computer, you pull them out of anything. You can't tell what they were in. They look pretty much the same. I mean, there might be some special devices somewhere and some, but so, you know, basically, if you have experience, I mean, after you do this a while, or you find somebody that's done this and tested a similar product, mm-hmm. they have a general benchmark in their mind of what they found that they can reach before the point of, and one point of fundamental limit technology is you're not getting one component, the same component on every sample failing. You're getting different random failures. That may indicate that you really reached the limits.
Mm-hmm.
But different industries also have different requirements. So like for downwell logging instruments in oil and gas.
Yeah, the sensoring and steering instruments.
Sensoring and actually processing, okay?
Yeah.
They had to, I was working with a company that had to use a microprocessor that would go into a 175C environment and had to have some margin beyond that.
Yeah.
I mean, it was expected that it would operate there, but you're talking about a very expensive production time for an oil well and drilling. And if it fails, it's going to cost you a lot. So this company did test an Arduino processor, and I told them, you know, we'll just keep going to it fails till it doesn't work as far as thermal stressing. I mean, that's a point of halt.
Mm-hmm.
And
well, they probably had trouble getting above 200C, just because because after that you're going to melt solder. I mean, at 212 for the old solder.
Okay, This is what happened. So they did get to 200C, but they didn't have the high temperature solder, which is what downwell drilling equipment uses for mm-hmm. circuit boards. It's 300C melting transition temperature. So it wasn't the component. It was really they'd reached the fundamental technology for their particular technical specialty.
Right.
And if they'd added, used in their industry, they would have used a solder, a 300C reflow solder, so that they could achieve a 200 or at least plus, 185 or whatever they're going to do. But I've worked with several equipment manufacturers, and they have said, you know, it still operates thousands of hours at those temperatures. So they kind of laugh at when they see the terrestrial and people, you know, consumer electronics worrying about 60C or even 100C, you know. And
no, you can go way past that, except we use a bunch of cheap connectors that melt.
Yeah, exactly. You know, and that was my biggest problem, VGA connectors on the motherboard. It was the plastic housing that was melting at 100. I think the hottest I ran a motherboard was about 140C. Now, that was one of the problems you have to overcome sometimes is built-in protection circuits
Over temperature things. You get a temperature rise on something and shuts you down.
CPUs, for instance, central processing, they all have a thermal shutdown that prevents them from going into a temperature condition that would cause errors in their processing to occur.
Right.
They're really not going to destroy the chip, but it is going to start malfunctioning. Signal times are going to be off.
Right.
So what I'd have to do there, and because CPUs were never really a significant reliability problem in PCs, and I don't think they are today. Mm-hmm. I would put a water block on that. I would essentially suppress that particular weakness in the fact that, you know, I couldn't get Intel or AMD to release the code.
Override that code. And I have run into prices where, you know, the system is that built in and we just override it. Or, like you said, put a water block on it. But the basic answer to this question that you got is there's a book by, I'm drawing a blank on his name. It was Quality is Free. Maybe you remember who wrote that, but way back
Duran?
When. No, it wasn't Duran. It was another group, Crosby, by Crosby.
Okay.
And his basic philosophy was, if you make improvements, if you make your product more robust and higher quality or both, it pays for itself. And the market will continue to demand more, in which we've seen in product after product after product.
Right.
Everything is supposed to be getting cheaper, faster, better, but higher quality, lasts longer, all those things. And so part of it is, when do you stop the process of doing halt and going back and doing it? Is when when you get to that technology limit, when your only failures is your melting solder. Now, there's still room for improvements in the consistency from one product to another. And then halt, it can be used to help you identify areas where they're, like you mentioned earlier, Kirk, is that if you have five products and they all fail for slightly different reasons, but at different, or the same reason, but at different points, that speaks to some inconsistency. Maybe the adhesive isn't applied properly, or the melting temperatures isn't controlled across the span of your board, or all those other variables that affect the eventual performance of your product. Right. Is you can still
hopefully you get a hard failure, so you can investigate that to the point of finding out the root cause of what that is.
That's right. And then you go back to your process, you go back to your vendor and look at process variability and try to solve that. And it's an ongoing process, and HALT is a tool to help you identify those failure mechanisms. So it's a great way to go about doing it.
Right. But, you know, there is a point of stopping. And as you said, usually it's because you run out of time and money, or the product's got to be released, and you fixed the major low-hanging weaknesses in the product.
Yeah.
And you've gotten it up to a reasonable, you know, for me, a reasonable level of thermal, what most systems should run to is be able to run at least solid state electronics 100C, if not better.
Yep.
And of course, that's way beyond any use environment. But you got to go find that out. You know, again, a lot of companies will stop at a halt test, say that's good enough, that's plenty of margin, and they really won't see at the top end maybe a huge variation between operating limits for either different components from, or the same functional component from different suppliers, causing a significant difference in operating limits, which then you would choose, you know, the higher capable component, mm-hmm. as far as that goes from the vendor, if you can. Mm-hmm. But some, you know, like computer manufacturers, they have to use multiple suppliers. So the other thing is, you know, another thing you should be doing is doing mixed builds with different critical components from different suppliers to see that they're all consistent, regardless of whose mix of components you use.
Yeah. Well, that's another whole topic there, how you deal with, you know, multiple vendors, and because that number of combinations gets really big pretty quick. But I think, did we answer both those questions, you think? Did we get a good picture?
I hope so. We'll certainly hope our listener will let us know if there's any additional follow-up or holes we left. But, you know, it's always an engineering judgment. And again, with HALT, you're never going to get enough samples, and you don't need enough samples. That's the whole point. But you also stop when you're not going to add, you know, special plastics or materials that aren't standard, you know, production materials. That's the point, is mm-hmm. not to go and put titanium where, you know, aluminum would do and it would hold. But, mm-hmm, mm-hmm. you know, you're not trying to, unless you're, say, the flight recorder box on a on a Boeing flight, and then you better be able to withstand
engine cowlings would be a good place to do stuff too.
But what's that?
Engine cowlings would be another place to make improvements.
We fall down here.
Yeah, well, let's wrap this one up. We'll save that for another topic. But the idea here is, you know, we really do appreciate when you send us a comments or questions and let us know that you're listening. That's always a great joy for us. We get a lot of our topics from emails or LinkedIn. You can find Kirk and I on LinkedIn or on our about pages at Ascendo. And you can also go to ascendoreliability.com/go/SOR for speaking of reliability. And there's a comment form there. You can join the discussion. So, you know, Kirk, I know we've talked about some of this stuff before, but did you realize that we have over 600 episodes now?
Yeah, I realize a lot of people that have picked up our podcast don't go back and listen to all 5 years.
That's right.
You know, of us discussing things, because we've tried to cover really what most people want to hear, we think.
Well, and also the questions that we get and things that come up. So anyway, Kirk, let's wrap this one up, and we'll come back and see what else we got in the box here.
Okay, Fred. Talk to you soon. Yeah.
Thanks for listening to Speaking of Reliability. We invite you to join the conversation. If you have a question or a topic that you think we should discuss in a future show, please let us know. You can find a comment box below the episode show notes, or just leave a note as part of a review on iTunes.